Blog Talk Radio.
My name is Bert Weisbord, and I'm here to talk with Leslie Briner, who is a human trafficking educator and consultant. Leslie managed Youth Care's residential program for trafficked youth called The Bridge. Before arriving at Youth Care, Leslie was program director of youth services at SAGE, that's Standing Against Global Exploitation, in San Francisco. At present, Leslie is the Commercial Sexual Exploitation Training and Policy Coordinator for Youth Care. She also operates a consulting practice. We're going to discuss sexually exploited youth and young adult homelessness. Corey Logan, the heroine of my new novel, Teaser, finds runaways, and once found, they become the client. So I've spent time thinking about some of the issues and questions I'll be raising with Leslie today. Teaser, the sequel to Inside Passage and the second thriller in the Corey Logan trilogy, was published in February of 2015. A portion of the proceeds from Teaser will be donated to Services for Homeless Youth in Seattle. Hello, Leslie, and thank you for being here.
Hello, Bert. Thanks so much for having me on today.
Let's jump right in. This is a big topic, and I'd like to sort of cover it as thoroughly as we can. The sexual exploitation of young people is a hard concept to even get one's head wrapped around, and yet the problem is pervasive. Would you speak to the intersection of youth homelessness, poverty, and exploitation?
Sure. And I appreciate that you frame it as the intersection of poverty and homelessness. I think there's a lot out in the trafficking field broadly who don't really understand how much of this is about poverty. You know, we talk about risk factors when it comes to sexual exploitation, and as an individual risk factor, you know, things like sexual abuse and a history of harm certainly create vulnerability for youth. But it's really about the poverty and what I refer to as the economic strategy. It's a huge part of what is driving families apart, that is creating situations where families are losing their housing. You know, we hear youth come in and say things in our drop-in center like, you know, my family can't afford me anymore. They had to downsize, and there's no space for me anymore. So all of those things that are driving youth to the streets are sort of one of the steps on this path. Now, not every youth who ends up homeless is going to end up in the formal end of the commercial sex trade, but many youth start out by engaging or being forced to engage in what we refer to as survival sex. And that's the exchange of sex for basic needs, roof over your head, food to eat, clothes, security. And so there's this really continuum of activity that we see. And some youth may trade sex just because they don't want to have to sleep outside. Some youth may become engaged in the more formal end of the sex trade. And some youth may, you know, just use this as an intermittent survival strategy to get their basic needs met.
Can you say a little bit more about what you call the formal end of the sex trade?
Sure. So I conceptualize the commercial sex trade when it comes to the youth, particularly the youth experience, as the informal end being, you know, really kind of this, like I said, the survival sex definition, right? Where they're not necessarily doing it all the time. Oftentimes they're working through their informal social network. So, you know, they might be couch surfing, but the person that they're couch surfing with is expecting some sort of sexual contact or activity for a spot on that couch. And then I conceptualize the formal end of the trade more as, you know, these stories where you have a third-party controller where, you know, the youth is under the control of a third party or under other forms of force, fraud, and coercion, where they're engaging in regular commercial sex with buyers, either through the internet or through the street, although with youth in our area, it's much more happening in the internet now. And those aren't really, you know, I think about that as a continuum. Those aren't static places. So, you know, youth can and do engage in various forms of this. You know, it is far more complex than people realize.
Yes, I actually want to come back to this, but first I want to ask, socially, the model of exploitation that is most often seen in movies and so on, other media, is a young girl and a controlling pimp. Yet exploitation can take form in a variety of ways. What are some of the ways that we sadly see youth involved in sexual exploitation that may be a surprise?
Yeah, I was so glad to see that question on there, because you're absolutely right. The way it is sort of discussed in media and conceptualized is what I call the narrative of the pimp-involved girl, right? And that's a very heteronormative, you know, it's a young, you know, often, you know, if there's a visual depiction depicted as white or light-skinned with a, you know, a serious or a significantly older male pimp. And not to say that that doesn't happen, it certainly does, but I don't think that it at all reflects the complexity and certainly the disproportionality of who's actually most impacted by this. And so I do a lot of training, I do a lot of talking about this issue, and I actually discuss 8 different forms of exploitation, and we probably don't have the time to go into all of them in detail, but in brief, you know, we have pimp-controlled situations. You know, in my purely anecdotal observations, that is, you know, probably only about a third now of what we see out there on our various caseloads and with youth we work with. I will say, though, that when I started doing this 10 years ago in San Francisco, that story was much more common, right? So we've seen a big shift in what I refer to, you know, as the marketplace, what youth would refer to as the life or the game. We've seen a big shift in that. And part of, I would say, the great equalizer in all of that is really the internet itself, but also the cheap and accessible smartphone technology. So the demographics of pimps have changed dramatically in 10 years. You see pimps of all genders. And I would say the most notable difference I've noticed is they've gotten a lot younger. So back in the day, you couldn't be 17 and, you know, pimping a stable of girls. That's just not really how it worked. And nowadays, because there are multiple instructional guides, you can go to your local bookstore and buy. And there are vast amounts of information on the internet about how to do this. You see younger people getting involved, where it used to be something that you kind of got raised up into, and you know, somebody taught you the game and sort of taught you how to do this, and that dynamic has changed. So the second one we talk about is gang-controlled exploitation, and that's been one of the biggest shifts in the market, certainly in the last, I'd say, 5 to 8 years. And one way, the easiest way I think about this is I'm not talking about pornography and strip clubs and that end of the commercial sex trade, but just the prostitution side of it. The vast majority of that used to occur on the street. You know, we don't know how much, and it probably varies region to region, but the vast majority of it was on what we call the street track. And so when that moved off the street, right, space and place, and it moved onto the internet to an unregulated, unfettered online marketplace of commercial sex, it allowed other people to get into that market with much greater ease. And so you saw, for a couple of reasons, I think gangs getting more heavily involved, and they use some different tactics to exploit youth that pimps do. The overarching end result is the same. It's just, you know, some kind of nuanced difference. So then we talk about the exploitation of boys, transgender, and gender variant youth. They tend to use more kind of anonymous hookup apps and social networks. This group you tend to see a little less under third-party control. Now, that should not mean that we ever think that there's less violence or victimization going on. Just the method of their exploitation looks a little different. We talk about family-based exploitation, which in my opinion is one of the most poorly recognized and poorly understood forms of this. And frankly, by the time most kids meet their pimps, there's been something in their early childhood or family of origin that has created a vulnerability to this. We talk about survival sex, which I defined for you earlier. We talk about what I refer to as peer-to-peer. And so that is when there are no adults involved, and either you have a minor pimping another minor, right, in the case of like a 17-year-old boy pimping his 16-year-old girlfriend, which we see a lot more commonly, more commonly we hear stories of really what I would refer to as the behavior of buying sex making its way into youth culture. So, you know, a popular, older, or more socially powerful young person approaching their younger or socially less powerful peer, generally in the context of a school, and offering them money for sexual activities. And then finally, we include sort of participation in other forms of the commercial sex trade as well. With youth, we are increasingly seeing sort of webcamming sites, which are, you know, where you've set up a particular webcam page and then buyers, you know, deposit money through either PayPal or Bitcoin or something to have them act out certain things via webcam. You also see some exploitation through sort of party circuits and club circuits and a couple of various other ways. So, you know, it's not just all your sort of, you know, prostitution in a hotel room. There's many other avenues that it happens through.
Wow. Okay. I think most people don't really understand the complexity and the variety and the way the internet has impacted all this.
Yes.
Historically, law enforcement has approached the problem by arresting prostituted people, which only re-victimizes them or can. And Washington State uniquely has been shifting laws and policies to focus on sex buyers.
Mm-hmm.
How has this helped or created challenges? Ultimately, sexual exploitation of young people is profitable, if you will, because there is a ready
mm-hmm.
group of buyers. I'm actually asking a couple of questions here, but I want to know about the shift in the Washington law, and I want to know if there is any typical profile for a buyer.
Sure. Those are both good questions. So I'll address the policy issue first, which is that, there has been movement at the state level. I would say that the most significant policy change is actually occurring in King County itself, really not, you know, across the entire state. Although, again, the state legislature did look at a bill this year. It ultimately didn't pass, but they considered a bill that would have created what we call an asymmetrical policy approach to prostitution that models what is referred to as the Nordic model. And so the easiest way to define that is that it would make the actual legal penalty for buying commercial sex a gross misdemeanor and therefore a more serious crime than selling sex, which is still a misdemeanor in most places. Now, when it comes to youth, buying access to someone under the age of 18 is a felony in the state of Washington. I believe now it is a felony in 49 out of 50 states. So that's a huge shift that happened in the last couple of years. For instance, it wasn't a felony anywhere in this country to pimp or buy a child until 2009. It wasn't a felony to pimp or buy a child in this state until 2011. So these laws and the scheme of policy work are still very, very new. So what has happened in Seattle and King County is that both Seattle Municipal Court, right, which handles municipal or smaller crimes, and King County Superior Court have created prostitution policies by which we are simply not arresting and charging prostituted individuals anymore. And the Seattle City Council did actually pass a law just about 6 months, or it wasn't a law, actually, it was a resolution, that said that changed the name of the crime that used to be referred to as patronizing, right? That's when a buyer would buy access to a prostituted person. And they changed the name of that law to sexual exploitation. And while it is a semantic shift, I do think that symbolically it's an important shift. So what we've seen in the last 5 years is really a switch from about a 10-to-1 ratio, meaning that for every 10 prostituted people that were arrested and charged, there was only one buyer. And now we see that on the opposite, the other end of that. So now they're essentially arresting and charging and convicting buyers at a 10-to-1 ratio of prostituted people. And that is tremendously significant. So we're really proud of that work that's been done here. Now, the larger question you asked around, is there a, is there a typology? This is a really interesting question and one that a lot of people would like an answer to. There is not yet any good research out there that really drilled down into typology, but I want to make a couple of comments about what we've learned about buyers. Separate from Youth Care's work, there is another group in Seattle, King County, that was funded by a national organization called Demand Abolition. And the King County Prosecuting Attorney's Office was co-granted funds with the Organization for Prostitution Survivors, which provides services to survivors, but also has a whole part of the organization that works on men's accountability, run by Peter Qualiantine, who's been doing this work for 20-plus years. He's just an extraordinary human being and male ally. And so they found some interesting things. We were trying to establish a baseline to figure out how much buying, right? Because we can't know if we've reduced something until we know what the baseline is. And they estimate through a various couple of methodologies that about 15% of the adult male population in King County buys commercial sex.
15%, did you say?
15%, yeah. But the, also the belief is that, so 15% is it could be a big or small number depending on how you think about it. What I like to think about is the fact that that also means that 85% of adult men do not buy commercial sex, which I actually find very helpful. And of that 15%, there's a much smaller group that are what we call high frequency buyers. So it appears that if you look at it from a kind of statistical level, that the majority of buyers really drill down to this very small group that are buying at a high frequency. But then there's this larger group that buy, you know, maybe once a month, maybe a couple times a year. So we don't know as much about their psychological typology. We are starting to figure out a little bit about their behavior, which is often where these things start. But the other thing, since this, your focus is on youth, about, you know, how, because it's very hard to parse out in this for a number of reasons, you know, how many of these people, if they knew she was, these buyers would, if they knew she was 15, would walk away, and how many people out there preferentially are looking for 14 and 15-year-olds. We don't know that yet. But we do know that King County Sheriff's Office set up a fake ad, which is one of the ways that they, you know, try to find these individuals. And the ad said in the body of the ad that it was, you know, the byline was something like "Hot Teen for You Tonight in Seattle," which they always have some creepy byline like that. And in the body of the ad, it said she was 15. Now, most people don't put that kind of information in ads anymore. So this was a very specific, targeted way to see, you know, how many people would call on this ad. And so in 2 hours that the ad was up, there was 252 unduplicated calls or emails on an ad to purchase access to a 15-year-old. That's one ad on one day.
Where was
on
it placed?
I think it was on Backpage. Backpage is the predominant one. But that being said, the same group in King County has identified 160 individual websites that service somewhere in King County. Now, that's a lot of websites. And that doesn't include, like, the hookup apps and the review boards and some of these. Those are just, like, your Backpage and Erotic Friend Finder and, you know, ads where if you go there, what you'll see is sort of listed ads for people. There's other kinds of websites out there that have slightly different functions. So to me, you know, who are these 252 guys that are going to call on an ad that explicitly says she's 15 years old? That's a pretty significant number, in my opinion. So we're still trying to figure out, but my personal theory, right, and again, I've worked mostly with young people. I don't do the demand work directly. But I believe there's sort of three groups out there when it comes to young people. And you have one group who's fairly small who, if they knew she was 15, they would absolutely walk away, right? They wouldn't do that. And then you have another smallish group that is preferentially absolutely looking for a 15 or someone young, right? That's what they want and that's what they're going after and it's on purpose. But I think the largest group, right, the most significant group, simply doesn't care, right? They don't care that she's 15. And the cultural foundation for that is once you are, you know, quote, and I only use this term from a teaching perspective, but once you are a prostitute, right, once you fall into that, what we refer to as the legitimate target group, your age becomes irrelevant. And the other evidence that we can point to is that we've been arresting kids as young as 12 and 13 years old for generations for something they can't consent to, right? And so we have to understand the way that that larger mentality of, like, well, once you're in this, you know, class of people, your age is irrelevant, and the general rules that are set out there to protect kids, they don't apply to you. And I think that you see that psychology amongst buyers as well.
Are buyers aware of the consequences of a 15-year-old as opposed to an 18-year-old?
Well, I think they're learning. I pointed out that we didn't felonize this until 2011 for a reason, and that's because, you know, in policy work, it takes a long time for policy to make its way into practice. And so if you look across the state of Washington, King County Superior Court has very, very aggressively gone after these, like, real aggressively gone after these cases with buyers who are buying access to children or to teenagers. But you don't see that at all in the rest of the state. So it takes a while. The demand abolition work that I referred to earlier with OPS and King County Prosecuting Attorney's Office, they have launched a campaign they refer to as Buyer Beware. And we really are trying to get the word out there that, you know, if you buy a 15-year-old, you're going to prison. And it's $5,000, it's a minimum $5,000 penalty, and you will be registered as a sex offender. Those are extremely stiff consequences, from one day in 2011 where this was a misdemeanor to the next day in 2011 where this was a felony and you're going to be a registered sex offender. So I think that we're starting to get the word out there, and we're starting there's some billboard campaigns and some other things happening here that communicates that. The other thing is that the Buyer Beware Project has a website. And on the website, it does say what the consequences are. It also links you to alternatives for support and help if you want to talk to somebody who's going to be non-judgmental and non-shaming about your sex buying behavior. We have a real value and ethic here about not shaming buyers and, you know, understanding that, you know, this hurts all of our humanity, and we're going to hold you accountable, and there's going to be consequences. But we do want to try to help unpack all of the very deep cultural and gendered reasons that men are buying in the first place. The last thing I was going to mention there is that in conjunction with an organization called Seattle Against Slavery, there's also been an online deterrence campaign. So these guys worked really closely with both Google and Bing to, you know, when you go to a Google search bar, the first couple of things that come up are sponsored ads. So they got Google to allow us to, when certain key terms like sex or teen or, you know, anything that's going to be used to search for escort ads, when those come up, instead of the ads, which are not allowed under certain key terms, right, they have what's called a blacklist of terms, they allowed us to set up deterrence ads. Well, not us, Seattle Against Slavery, but, and it says things like, you know, if she's under 18, you could be registered as a sex offender, or there's help and support for you. So we've taken it directly to where buyers are, which is the internet. We've put out information through press releases and ad campaigns. And then the cops are out there, you know, trying to, again, preferentially really looking for these people who are buying access to children. But they're doing larger sting operations with adult prostituted individuals as well. So I would say that we've tried to put together a pretty comprehensive approach to getting the word out there.
Do you feel like it's working? Do you feel like the numbers are moving in the right direction? And is there any evidence of this?
Well, I would say it's still way too new to know that. So we did the baseline data collection. It sort of started at the end of last summer, but in full effect in fall of last year. So in And that was just baseline, and even that was fairly complicated to figure out because we had to use several different methodologies and sort of triangulate and figure, you know, because there's the rate of people that are buying online, but there's still some street-based activity. So, you know, it's a little complicated to sort of figure out how that all works together. And we haven't gone back and done a second data point yet. So we won't have any real, and we'll be doing that, but not until this summer. So we won't have any clear understanding of that until, you know, we do additional data collection. But what I will tell you I do find incredibly hopeful is that, you know, first of all, we've got so King County, which is the county that Seattle's in, has 36 municipalities in it. It's the big, big county. It's got several million people in it. And the vast majority of those municipal cities are on board with this. And so what that means is they are setting up sting operations. They are looking for buyers. They are not arresting prostituted individuals. If they pick them up, they are referring them to services. Now, this is not perfect by any stretch. And if you have a warrant, you're still going to get arrested because there's no way around that. But the approach on the ground from law enforcement has shifted dramatically. And part of what we're hearing from women who we work with on our survivor services side is, you know, the cops are treating them better and the cops aren't, you know, hassling them and they're, you know, talking to them like they're human beings and they're referring them to services and they're actually seeing the buyers get arrested. Yeah, so that, I mean, you know, we have this amazing opportunity, particularly within ops, just because of the unique way this organization is designed, to see both what survivors have to say about what's going on the street, and then you got Peter on the other side doing the work with men. And some of what I find incredibly hopeful in that program is that, so most Johns, just to give you a little context, most what we used to call John schools, we refer to them as buyer intervention programs up here, used to be basically like traffic court, right? So you'd come in, you'd do your six-hour class. It was a diversion, you know, as long as you did your class, it didn't show up on your record. And, you know, the classes were 6 or 7 hours based on a public health model, and they'd shame the men a little bit and, you know, tell them that they're going to catch STIs. And so Peter has designed a very, very different kind of a class. And so it is now a condition of sentencing. It is no longer a diversion. So even though you do your class, it's going to still be on your record. And it is 8 weeks, right? So it is,
wow.
It is one night a week for 3 hours for 8 weeks. So it is a long-term class where he can really spend some time unpacking, you know, what are the reasons that this is going? Is this serving you and your family? Does this reflect your higher values and integrity? And it starts with 2 sessions of motivational interviewing, which we also think is quite remarkable. But the really amazing takeaway, and Peter said, you know, one of his barometers for whether or not this was going to work was how many guys chose to go after the mandated class, right, because you have to go, the court says you have to. But there's a voluntary support group that men can join after. And a number of men have joined the support group. Several men have now come on board to become volunteers with ops. And there's actually a guy, one of the guys that was arrested for commercial sexual abuse of a minor, right, so the big felony that I was talking about. He is, of his own volition, going through a second round of 8 weeks of class because he found it so helpful and so transformative in his life. So, you know, if men are coming back on their own to join a voluntary support group, to volunteer with the agency, or to frankly just go do the class again, that tells me that something that is happening in that space is working. And while we're still too young to say exactly what it is, we have some theories, but, you know, we're going into the fourth cohort, so they've had about 30-some guys go through it. It's still very new. It just started in January. But the early results seem incredibly promising.
That's great. Let me shift gears here for a moment, because
sure.
There's another aspect of this that I think people are interested in. Employees mm-hmm. at hotels, bars, and restaurants, maybe the first and only adults, and I guess we should include in this not just employees, people who are at these hotels, bars,
mm-hmm.
and restaurants, adults to see a potential victim of exploitation? What are some common signals, and what, if anything, should businesses and individuals do to help ensure safety?
Sure, that's another great question. Well, I think that as far as what would be the red flags in that kind of setting, so the red flags that I teach service providers are a little different than the red flags that you're talking about, but really what this looks like is a much older adult with one or more younger people that do not look like either their kids or their family, where it would appear that, you know, they don't really know each other very well. And this is a real nuanced thing. So this is tough to kind of nail down. And a patron in a hotel is probably a little less likely maybe to notice something like this. But we have an organization here called Businesses Ending Slavery and Trafficking. And the very first project that BEST took, which is to leverage the power of business to interrupt human trafficking and exploitation, and one of the very first projects that they took on was something called Inhospitable to Trafficking, and it specifically goes out and trains hoteliers. But it did something a little different. Other people have tried to go out and just train hoteliers on red flags and, you know, hotel staff, like, you know, concierges and those types of folks. But what Mars organization did was actually set up a process, three meetings that they brought local law enforcement and hoteliers together to come up with some agreements and some sort of standards of practice that they could both buy into. And one of the historical reasons that hoteliers have not been proactive, I mean, if you're working at a hotel front desk, like, you see this. And I think most people actually know it when they see it, too. But because of our larger cultural beliefs around prostitution, right, that's oldest profession, victimless crime, consenting adults, even if she looks, you know, kind of young, hoteliers have a real sense about wanting to keep confidential and private their clients' information. And so there's not been a great historical relationship on this particular issue between law enforcement and hoteliers. Hoteliers have a vested interest in not having a bunch of cops in their lobby and not having the lights and sirens flashing out front. And, you know, and what if we think this is going on but we're wrong? You know, then we've offended our clients and they go back to their business and say, you know, don't ever stay at that hotel again. The hotelier, you know, accused me of something I wasn't doing. So there's lots of very complicated reasons why hoteliers in particular have had don't ask, don't tell sort of policy. So what we've tried to do is, in the spirit of transparency, I do sit on the board for BEST. So what they've tried to do is create a process so they train the hoteliers. These are the red flags. They have, you know, materials that hang on the housekeeping carts that say, you know, these are the red flags to look for. And then they have a region-by-region process that they make those referrals to law enforcement. And so they get a chance to make those agreements ahead of time that say, you know, when we call you, can you come in the back door and can you come out without the lights and sirens? This has also led to certain hoteliers allowing law enforcement to use their hotels to do sting operations, which is something that hoteliers, you know, historically were not very interested in doing for a number of reasons. They can clarify what sort of information can be shared. You know, it typically, if a cop wants information about a hotel guest, they have to come in with a warrant. So they've, you know, kind of created some practices around that. And also, frankly, hoteliers have taught us some things that we didn't know about how to red flag this. So, you know, we were told by one hotel group that, you know, they're flagged when somebody through an online, a third-party booking system like, you know, Expedia, for instance, calls in or through the internet and they book a group of rooms with a prepaid credit card that's not traceable, and they ask for a, quote, quiet side of the hotel. So, you know, they've been able to teach us some things because they do see this, and we've been able to open the channels with law enforcement so that they can make appropriate referrals. And then when they're seeing adults, who they don't want to see criminalized, they have resource cards that they can give them. But if they suspect anybody is either under forced fraud or coercion or under the age of 18, they have a protocol by which to call law enforcement. And we think that is a really promising emerging practice to be used. But essentially, what any person on the street should do if they suspect this is they can either call the national hotline that is run by Polaris, and they can route any caller from any part of the country back to the correct people in their region, or they can simply call 911 and they can call law enforcement. Depending on where you are in the country, that might get you a good response or not. But fortunately, I think if people in King County called, most of our law enforcement have received extensive training, and I hope that we would use a victim-centered response with any person we found, adult or minor, who was in this situation.
Well, that really leads to my next question, which is, you know, as I listen, I'm learning about all sorts of what I think are important things happening in King County, and and I'm wondering how many other states and cities and counties are picking up on these things, and whether this is the beginning of sort of a national change.
Yeah, you know, that's an interesting. I keep abreast of what's going on. I mean, you know, part of the awesome thing in my job at this point in my career is I get to talk to a lot of different people from a lot of different places about what's going on. And I do think that there's something uniquely innovative and cutting edge that is happening here in King County that I am not seeing in other parts of the country. The Demand Abolition Initiative, for instance, that I mentioned, they fund, I think there's now 11 cities, and I can tell you with 100% certainty that Seattle King County is the leader in that project, that we are looked to as both kind of the conceptual leaders and political leaders, and that in very large part is because we have state and local stakeholders, legislators, city council people, you know, our elected prosecuting attorney, Dan Satterberg, and Pete Holmes, the city attorney from Seattle, you know, people that have traditionally, particularly your prosecutors, right, traditionally have not been on the side of prostituted people and have not been on the side of holding buyers accountable and, you know, creating victim-centered approaches. But there have been people on the ground here for 10, 15, 20 years that have been chipping away at this. And so I think what we're seeing is actually, you know, a tipping point where we have enough public support, where we have enough stakeholders on board, where we've gotten enough funding to place people on the ground to, you know, I mean, it takes a lot of work to go out and train all the cops, and it takes a lot of work to go talk to hundreds of judges about, you know, conditions of sentencing, and then certainly the services for both adults and for young people. So I think that there's some interesting work happening in other places, certainly. What we have not seen, that I'm aware of yet, is another municipality as large as ours that is really using these asymmetrical policy approaches that are actively trying to decrease the number of arrests and convictions on prostituted people and increase the number of arrests and convictions on buyers. The way that buyers are being gone after in other jurisdictions are very, very heavily law enforcement based, and that's one part of it. But nowhere else in the country is there a program like Peter's Buyer Intervention Program. Nowhere else in the country is there a business project like I mentioned. And the hotel piece is just part of it. You know, that organization is also working on a code of conduct for businesses. And as you know, Seattle King County has we're flagship to a lot of big, particularly tech businesses. So I do think we're starting to see a shift. But when you asked earlier what some of the challenges had been to these shifts, and I didn't address it back then, but there's a real backlash to this work. And one of the things that I'm aware of is that sometimes I and my colleagues and live in what I refer to as the anti-trafficking bubble. And we just think that everybody thinks the buyers should be arrested for this and, you know, that prostituted people should get services and empathy and care. There's a lot of people that don't think that. And when we tried to pass the state legislation that would change patronizing to sexual exploitation and increase the penalty to a gross misdemeanor, we saw a huge, huge backlash in this state. And it is because people have very complicated and, frankly, ill-informed and ill-developed ideas about the commercial sex trade. And there is a whole contingent of folks in liberal old Western Washington that believe that part of the message you're hearing up here that is unique to Washington is, well, if we legalize marijuana, why can't we legalize prostitution? So as we've worked on these asymmetrical policy approaches, one of the things happening is it is organizing sort of the other side, if you will, and I hate to use the binaries, but it applies here. The other side, which is actively trying to get prostitution fully legalized, that believe that, kids shouldn't be involved in this, but once you're 18 in the day, you're a consenting adult, and the criminalization is harmful. I personally and politically don't agree with those viewpoints, but, this is going to be a challenge. Anybody that takes this on suffers significant backlash from organizations that are pro-sex industry and pro-legalization. And let me tell you, that side of the argument is way, way, way better funded than the work that we're doing. There is a multi-billion dollar commercial sex industry out there that has a lobby. They don't talk about it like that the way we do in other industries, but there's absolutely a sex industry lobby out there that will spend lots of money to send people all over and talk about how, sex work should be legalized and how it's so much better in these other European countries that have legalized, which is, I don't agree that that is true. So these are the significant challenges. Is we are coming up against the court of public opinion, and because it has just been illegal for so long in this country, we're having to really unpack what people's cultural beliefs and values are about this issue, and it is not easy, and it is not always pretty. So that's, I'd say, the biggest challenge that we're facing at the macro level.
We're running out of time, and we maybe ought to do a second interview sometime, because I think that your work is so interesting, and you're really articulate about communicating the issues. I want to cover one last thing, though,
sure,
which is on a little different note, which is, in your experience, what do currently and formerly exploited youth need to heal and move forward? I mean, I'm sure that some of your work addresses that.
Yeah. And I spent, until I moved into policy and training, I was a direct service provider. I had the distinct privilege to run two of the first five residential recovery programs in this country. And so I've spent most of my time on the ground with young people. And what I like to say is everything I know I learned from them. There's no broad literature base that you can go to. There's no best practices or evidence-based practice for this yet. And I have sort of two overarching lessons that I like to communicate to people. And the first is that relationship, transformative relationship, is the intervention. We made a big, mistake, actually, mistake might be a little strong because we were doing the best we had available to us at the time, but when this movement first started, right, when it first started getting catalyzed in the late 2000s, we focused on the resident, like the beds, right? There's only 100 beds, and there's only 150 beds, and, that's true, right? That was a true statement, but what it led people to believe was that if you opened these housing programs and you had this great staff and you just could train the cops to be more empathetic and to go out and pick these kids up and to bring them to a program instead of taking them to detention, that the kids would be so grateful and they would stay there and they would, heal and take advantage of all of these things that were being offered to them. And that was a fail, right? That was what I refer to as the "if you build it, they will come" myth. And what happened all over the country was people invested millions of dollars into housing programs that were not connected to people in the community, and the cops would go pick the kids up and drop them at the program, and the minute the cop was around the corner, the kid was out the back door. And the simple, complicated, but fundamental reason why was that they didn't have any relationship with the people in those programs. Now, at the Bridge, you know, we did end up going through a redesign, but our retention rate was very high, and it was because we did not take kids into that program that we did not have a pre-existing relationship with. You have to get through rapport and trust building before they're going to stay put in a housing program. And there's a lot of reasons why that we don't really have time to go into in any depth, but think about it this way. If you're 15 years old and there's a bunch of adults around you that have said, you're grown, your job is to make money, this is what you do, this is your family, and simultaneously have said, you don't belong in that world anymore, you're not worthy of a life free of violence and exploitation, sort of this is your lot in life now, this is what you do, the shame and the trauma and the various impacts that that has on a young person, they don't feel like they deserve that soft bed that doesn't want anything from them, right? So you have to do a lot of work to rebuild self-esteem and agency and their belief in their self before they're ever going to stay put. And the only context in which you can do that well is through a caring relationship. And, you know, one of the things I say to our advocates, right, which is largely the people that fulfill that role in our community, sometimes we call them case managers or mentors or other things, we call them advocates, you know, they spend a lot of time, they don't want anything from the kids. We're not talking about a service plan day one. We really get to know them as human beings, and we really let them see us as human beings, and we have a real human relationship. And I personally think in a decade of doing this work, that is the single most important thing that I've learned. The second thing, and again, I mentioned this earlier when you asked about poverty, and I think that we are sort of failing to talk about this in this movement, is what I refer to as reframing the economic strategy. So prostitution and the commercial sex trade, particularly with kids, is violent, and it is brutal, and it is traumatic, and it is all of those things. It is also an economic strategy. And if your listeners imagine I'm sort of holding up my smartphone, right, the reality is in 2015, in 5 minutes, you can take a picture on your little selfie in your bathroom mirror, you can post it to Backpage, you can wait 5 seconds for those 252 buyers that are going to call, you can have one of them pay for the hotel room of your choice, and you can work out of that hotel as long as you want. Or somebody else can make you work out of that hotel as long as they want you to. But the reality is that there is a figurative tap of money that gets turned on and turned off at whim. It is not the same way we make money in the square world, right? There's no, you know, if I try to go out there and get a job, it's going to be 6 weeks between when I start looking for a job and probably when I'm going to see my first paycheck. Anybody in the commercial sex trade can go out there in a couple hours and walk away with at least a couple $100. So when you're talking about an adolescent, right, and an adolescent brain that's still forming, typically that's got a history of, you know, abuse or harm, and, you know, this is how they understand money, that really has a significant impact. So they need employment options. They need internships. They need a way to see and a way to learn about making money that is not ride on their self-worth and doesn't, you know, is free from violence and exploitation. So the relationship is key, addressing the economic strategy is key, and then education, housing, mental health counseling, drug and alcohol services are all part of that. But the priority from the standpoint of the youth is, do you care about me? Can you help me figure out another way to support myself? And then we take it from there.
Thank you, Leslie. This has been very informative. And a couple of things. To learn more about youth care, the listeners can go to www.youthcare.org. I don't know if there are other websites you'd like to send people to, Leslie, that more.
Well, if anybody's interested in that demand work that I mentioned, they can look at opsseattle.org.
No, that's helpful. And to learn more about my book, Teaser, in the Corey Logan Trilogy, you can go to www.bertweisbord.com. So, Leslie, I would like to follow up on this sometime, and I just this point want to thank you, and I will send you a follow-up.
Great, and thank you for, you know, your attention to this and getting it out there. You know, the more people know, the more we can do. So thanks for your attention to this issue as well, Bert. I appreciate it.
Okay.
Great.
Talk soon. Bye-bye, Leslie.
Yeah, thank you. Bye-bye.